Good morning, Judith. It's lovely to have you here. Could you take a moment to introduce yourself, please?
So thank you for having me, Madeline. I'm Judith, the Confidence Eater, and I'm from the Confidence Eater.
So what does the Confident Eater do?
Okay, so I'm a picky eating advisor. So I work exclusively with parents who have children who they would deem fussy, picky, selective, or directly with teens who, again, have eating challenges, not anorexia or bulimia, but they have challenges eating foods that they'd like to eat.
Okay. What interests you about supporting parents to support children?
Well, I'm the daughter of two teachers, so the apple didn't fall far from the tree. Although I never wanted to be a teacher, actually, I love learning. And so I've got two degrees, and I'm currently completing my Master of Science to match up with my Master of Arts. And there's probably a PhD in the future. So I like to get get that information, but then I love to share it too. And I'm never happier than when I'm sharing my knowledge. And there's such a need. I think it's really true when they say babies don't come with a manual, because they don't come with a manual. And unfortunately, parenting's so complex. And I think especially in the modern world, it's got even more difficult than it used to be. I think, we used to have the village, and there used to be a lot of parental input and very little external input, and now there seems to be just so much noise out there, and it's so easy to inadvertently make mistakes as a parent. I mean, I know, because I've done that, and I think things can move really quickly. Small problems can just blow into huge problems just without, we blink and suddenly something's become a protracted issue. And parenting's hard. We work, we keep the house running, we have to have a relationship with our partner, we have to have a social life, we have to exercise, and then on top of that, we're supposed to squeeze in the parenting too. And sometimes just a little bit of extra help is all we need just to keep those plates spinning. If we have a car that's not running well, we go to the mechanic. But if things are not going well with our parenting, we tend to go, And so much of the time we just let it go and let it go and let it go. And it's not that we don't want to fix it, and it's not that we don't try to fix it. It's just that, we can spend a lot of time bumping heads without realizing it. And then that little problem becomes the big problem. And there is that reluctance to get help in the parenting sphere. Whereas if we've got a problem with the car or the washing machine, we get someone in straight away. And perhaps, a little bit arrogantly, I believe that I can make a difference. And so I love to make a difference. In fact, my dream would be that the parents of every 5-month-old, every 11-month-old, and every 16, 17-month-old gets some really good, solid education and advice around feeding, because those are your transitions. So before you start feeding solids, it would be awesome to have all the information about feeding solids. Before your child sort of transitions from that milk is your primary food to solids are your primary food, it would be great to get some advice. Before your child goes into what is naturally and, even from an evolutionary point, a normal neophobic phase, which is when, they tend to reject foods. If we knew what to do about that, then so few parents then would fall into, the picky eating sort of traps. Mm. And things would be so much easier, and really that would be my dream.
Fantastic. So when you see concerns from parents who do have picky eaters, what are the current concerns that you see them having to work through?
Well, there's so many, but I think a lot of it's that there's a lot of competing information. There's so much noise out there, and a lot of it's conflicting. So you go on the internet and you get advice and you go, okay. And then you read something else and you're like, oh, hang on, that's in direct conflict to what I've just read. Do I do this and do I do that? And so if my child doesn't eat dinner, well, is it okay for them to go to bed hungry? Or, should I be making sure that they have food? And, there's a ton of gray areas. And I think we're also living in the area of the healthy prescription. You know, you must do this, your child should eat that. And that puts enormous pressure on parents because, of course, we see these, you know, beautiful, you know, Instagram and Facebook memes that say, well, you know, if you don't eat this, this and this, then, you know, you're not getting all your nutrients. And then we look at our child and we're like, but my child doesn't eat half of that. Are they growing okay? You know, are they getting all the nutrients they need? Is their brain going to develop okay? All of that sort of stuff. And then there's a lot of pressure from schools. They know all the healthy lunchbox stuff. There's a lot of pressure from other parents about what goes in your lunchbox and what your child does and doesn't do. And then there's a lot of pressure from family and friends. And unfortunately, again, the advice from the school, the advice from other parents, and the advice from family and friends, all of that might be all conflicting. And then you're sort of stuck in the middle and don't really know where to go. I think another one of the big problems at the moment is access to options. So when I was young, you know, there was the old packet of biscuits or packet of crisps, but beyond that, there wasn't really a lot of options. If you didn't eat the meal, there weren't all these other options. Whereas at the moment, there's so many sort of meal replacement things, and the snack options, the manufacturers have got amazing at making them moorish so that we crave them, marketing them in a way that makes them irresistible, and particularly to children. And it's really easy to see why children prefer the snacks to the nutrient dense food. I mean, really, who doesn't? You know, some of them are fantastic, you know. And so again, I think that's that, you know, that whole food environment is really, really difficult. And then we've also got, often as parents, competing challenges. It's not just eating issues, but families can often be facing, you know, multiple issues. And if you have a child who has challenges and other challenges, you know, be it ASD or ADHD or sensory sensitivities or generalized anxiety or whatever that might be, unfortunately, that often goes hand in hand with eating challenges. And so then you, as a parent, naturally, you have to pick your battles. You can't fight everything. And so you look at, well, what's my biggest issue? And if you're solving your biggest issue, some of the other issues might just have to take a back seat because you just don't have time and energy for everything. And then, of course, the eating issues often get bigger and bigger and bigger.
Golly. So out of all of those things, what's the concern that you have the most for parents and for children?
I think I'm gonna reframe what you've just asked me, because I think the problem as I see it is a societal problem. So I think we have it's a societal problem on a lot of levels. So firstly, we have, as I said before, very little education. We've got lots on breastfeeding and nursing and lots on transitions to solids. And after that, there's actually very little sort of commonly accepted advice. And so what information is there on feeding an older child? And then what happens if things go wrong? You know, there we just, we go, well, if something goes wrong and I've got a three-year-old or a four-year-old, it's really difficult to actually find any help. And then we just don't see feeding challenges the same, in the same way as we see other childhood challenges like reading or talking or any of these things. We say, well, it's the parent's fault. We say it's a phase and they'll grow out of it. And we say it's not something to worry about. And I take an issue with all of that, because I don't think any of those things are true. And if we look at the stats, and there's some stats published last year out of the University of Auckland that say that we've got enormous numbers of children who have really severe eating issues. Eating issues can easily become protracted by the time a child is four. So that means, you know, they're not going to grow out of it. If they're already four and this is already a big problem, it could be up to 10% of children. I mean, that's enormous amounts of children who are really struggling with food. And also, and I think this one's quite a sobering one, that if you do have, you know, quite severe eating challenges, then a large percentage of those actually get worse over time rather than getting better. So then when we're telling people it's only a phase, we're really doing them a disservice because, you know, instead of fixing it when the child's four, we're waiting for this phase to suddenly go away. And actually, by the time they're seven, eight, nine, it's got worse. Mm-hmm. And that's really upsetting for me.
Yeah.
And we don't talk about these numbers. And they're widely available. And the medical profession as a whole are not seeing this and not acknowledging this, you know. Okay.
So we can put that maybe that link to those statistics.
Yeah, absolutely.
So that would be really cool. So given all of that, Judith, that's kind of a grim picture. What do you think can be done to overcome the challenges and the concerns?
Well, I think firstly, we need to change the way that we view eating challenges. So if parents know. So if you think there's something wrong with my child's eating, they just don't seem to be doing this in the way that I'd expect. They don't seem to be eating like the other children or my other, you know, if you've got siblings, the other siblings. It just seems something that's not quite right. Then the chances are you're correct. You know, no one knows a child as well as you do. And parents always say, but he never really liked food, or well, she was always a little bit frightened of new foods. You know, if you're sitting at home and you're thinking, this is not going right, then the chances are it's not going right. And what's really interesting is that there's a lot of myths out there about eating. And one of the ones I think is really quite frightening is that we say, food for under 12 months old is just for play. You know, and there's a lot of truth in that. You know, it's important that our child plays with food, and it's important that we don't put pressure on them and that milk is still the primary food. All of that's true. But if your child is not eating food by 10 months, if your child's not able to eat table foods, so we're talking, you know, your average, the stuff, the chicken and the carrots and the stuff that you would eat at your table, by 11 months old, there's probably something going wrong. Now, it might be something really little, but if we identify that there's a challenge when the child's 10 months or 11 months old and we go, okay, there's obviously a problem there, they're having a little bit of a problem chewing, or, you know, they're having some sensory issues, boom, we can work on those and then we can get them going well. And so the earlier we identify that there's a challenge, then the quicker we can fix it. And if we say, I think there's a problem, and we go to fix it and actually there's not a problem, well, then that's really comforting too, because it's nice to know, well, actually, I don't need to worry, it's all good. Mm. Off I go.
What would be a couple of things that parents who are listening who think that maybe this is a problem for them, either around the scaring, being scared of food, or the sensory thing, what could be a couple of things you could share with them now that might help them?
So if you are looking at, if you do have a really, you know, a baby and then they're not eating well, then, you know, perhaps that's, it's worthwhile going to see your doctor and just seeing if you can get an assessment of you know, their oral motor skills, and you can just like get a referral to like an occupational therapist or a speech language therapist that specializes in feeding, and they can just have a look at the mechanics of things and how things are working.
And if you don't feel that you want to take that step, but you want to see if you can do something at home by yourself, what kinds of things could they do?
So if you've got a really young child, then a lot of it's, if you've got mechanical problems, then that's really difficult to fix as a parent on your own. And if they've got sensory issues, then it's often establishing what those sensory issues are, so then you can help work on them. So once you've identified what the problem is, then often there are solutions out there, but you kind of need to identify what the challenge is first. But there are a lot of 10 and 11 months who, you know, are going to mess around and they're not really going to want to eat. So I don't want to scare anyone now. Mm. And so a lot of it comes back to us and how we feed and how we set up the feeding environment, because the feeding environment and our approach to food is probably the most important thing. And even if we do have a child who has some challenges, often we can override a lot of that just by what we do. So that would be making sure that food is really relaxed and it's fun and it's pleasurable. It's sharing, not staring. So every photo we see of a, you know, a parent feeding a child is the parent sitting, you know, on one side of the picture and the child sitting on the other and the parent sort of stuffing the food in the child's mouth. And I always think that if I'm with somebody and I go out for dinner, I want them to be eating as well as me eating. And it's the same for our baby, that if they're eating, then we should be eating and we should be role modeling eating. And it's not that we have to eat the jarred baby food, but we can be eating the peas while they're eating the mushy version. You know, and that creates just that warm environment. It's then making sure that when our child comes to the table, that it is a nice, relaxed, and it's an easygoing sort of relationship. And whether you're feeding them or whether they're, you know, baby led weaning doesn't really matter. It's just that they have some sort of autonomy around their food so that they are, you know, sort of learning to do this independently and learning to do this in their own way and with just with support from you.
Yeah, that's really lovely to give those specific ideas that parents who might be listening. The other question that has I've been thinking about is, we've been talking quite a lot about smaller children or younger children. What about if we do end up with eating or problems with our older children? What do you think can be done for teens or tweens?
And to be honest with you, that's more where I sit than within the baby end. So I should probably talk more about that anyway. Look, again, I think if we've got a 4, 7 or 14-year-old that's not eating well, then we need to identify that as a problem, you know, mm-hmm. And especially if our 7-year-old has gone, you know, 5 years without eating well, or our 14-year-old has gone 12 years without eating well, the chances are there's something really going wrong there. And again, what we want to do is step back and say, is this something I can solve myself? And the chances are the answer to that is no, because if you could solve it, you would have solved it by now. And is it magically going to resolve itself? Has your child added any new foods in the last, you know, X number of months? Has their approach to food changed? All of those things. And if you're honest and say, well, really, they've added one new food in the last, you know, year or so, and they might be dropping foods, and really their approach to food is disordered or it's uncomfortable, then you probably need to get some help. And sometimes it actually doesn't take a lot to change what's happening. A few tweaks and we can get things rolling in a very different way, because often we're inadvertently doing things that are impeding progress and we don't even realize that. But somebody looking from the outside, it's not always so much easier to look in from the outside than it is when you're stuck, you know, in the middle of the trees. It's very hard to see the wood for the trees, but looking from above and looking externally is much easier to do that. And sometimes all it takes is a few tweaks in the way that we talk about things and we do things, and our child can get rolling again.
Yeah. So where do you think you could point parents to get resources and to get support?
Unfortunately, one of the big problems we have is that there is very little support available. I mean, there genuinely is so little support and there's so little funding. if you do think your child's got mechanical problems, you know, there's some problems with chewing or whatever it might be, your GP's your first port of call. And if your GP's not interested, then you go see a different GP. And until you get someone who's going to listen to you and is actually going to do that. I give away a lot of free information and a lot of free resources on my website, so theconfidenteater.com, or on my Facebook page, The Confident Eater. And I'm always happy to talk to any parent who, if you think your child's got a problem and you're not quite sure, then you can come talk to me for free. And I'm more than happy to do that and to do an initial evaluation and just have a look what's happening. And if I can help you, great. And if I can't help you, then I can refer you on to somebody who I think might be able to help you.
I understand you've also got a book or a couple, have you?
Yeah, I've got a couple of books. And they're a really budget-friendly way to work through my programs. And the way that I would work with families, if I work with them personally, a lot of that's gone into the book. So there's Creating Confident Eater, Creating Confident Eaters, and Winner, Winner, I Eat Dinner. And both of those work you through how to change your child's eating, but in really simple, gentle, practical steps. And it's all very, very practical, you know, hands-on, slot into your routines. It's really user-friendly. And it's really accessible. So it's not written in science speak. It's all, okay, at the mealtime, let's do this. Let's make it fun for our child. Let's make it relaxed for our child. And that's the whole ethos behind it.
I remember having a conversation with you, Judith, that and you shared a little piece of advice about sensory issues for young children and the fact that many of our kids don't run around with bare feet anymore. And what you explained was that actually we learn about texture through our feet, and therefore if we can help our children to get back to experiencing texture through our feet early in our years, then sometimes we prevent sensory problems from occurring. Is that have I got that right?
I don't know that it prevents sensory problems from occurring, but it helps the whole sensory system if we do things like we have our child walk on the grass, walk on the sand, you know, all of those things are really good sensory input. And it helps to desensitize the body. Playing, digging in the mud, you know, digging in the sand, all of lifting leaves, you know, in the garden with the grass clippings, all of that stuff, in the kitchen, kneading dough, all of that sort of stuff works with our sensory system and gets us used to different textures and all of that's really, really positive. In the same way as playing with your food is awesome. And we can do that in a way that's culturally sensitive. We can do that away from the table and it's got nothing to do with eating, but we can have our child in the kitchen cooking with us, which is really playing with your food, because if you're cracking eggs or you're grating carrots or you're doing all of that sort of stuff, it's great for both sensory and supporting better eating.
Right. So what would your last comment be for parents who are listening today?
If there's a problem, you know there's a problem, and if there's a problem, the quicker you tackle it, the less years of habits and the less you have compromised to make things work. And we always compromise to make things work because we need to feed our child.
So thank you very much for talking with me today, Judith. I really appreciate you and the deep thinking and research and work that you've done to help our parents across New Zealand to be able to support their children to be fabulous, and keep doing your good work. And I look forward to seeing your qualification at the end of that piece of work that you're doing currently. Thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you. It's been fabulous to have you to be on here. And if anybody wants to come and talk to me, you know, please do.
Okay, and we'll put the information about how to contact you in the information on the podcast.
Fantastic, thank you.
Thank you. But thank you very much for taking the time to talk with me today and for sharing your fabulous ideas. Remember, if you want some more support, please go to www.resilientkids.org.nz. Reach out. I'm really happy to reply to an email if you're wanting resources and or to pick up some support through coaching or our online parenting course. Go well. Take care. Thank you.